In this episode of From Bench to Fireside, Pisces Chief Scientific Officer John Connolly talks to Dr. Katie Campbell about how her doctoral studies led to a fascination with mining cancer genomics data to match patients to targeted therapies. Cancer research is on the cusp of a new era, where advanced technologies hold newfound promise for the field's most complex mysteries. Dr. Campbell is an emerging leader in cancer informatics. And through her work, she is figuring out how to decode the secrets of the tumor microenvironment. Get ready to go from bench to fireside as we dive into the fascinating frontier of cancer informatics with 2023 Parker Bridge Fellow, Dr. Katie Campbell.
I'm John Connolly, and I'm here with Dr. Katie Campbell.
So I'd like to welcome Dr. Katie Campbell. Katie's a postdoctoral research fellow at UCLA, and she works extensively really in the informatics space, really looking at a lot of the data that's coming out of our clinical trials and try to understand mechanisms of action and resistance to immunotherapy, particularly in the checkpoint space and in melanoma, which is a big drive here at the Parker Institute. It's something we're incredibly focused on, solid tumor biology, and trying to better understand how we can take immunotherapy approaches to tackle that. And I think Katie's work has really shined over the past few years in this informatics space, really leveraging the samples that are available, the techniques that she and her lab are developing to really get a much better understanding of the tumor microenvironment in melanoma. So Katie, tell me a little bit more about your current role and maybe your background that led you here.
I'm Dr. Katie Campbell. I'm a fifth year postdoctoral fellow at the University of California in Los Angeles. I'm a fifth year postdoc in Tony Rivas's lab with a background in cancer genomics and bioinformatics. I'm now applying those skills to larger translational studies to patients with melanoma treated with various immunotherapies. For the people that know me, they know I don't do any molecular biology anymore, but all of my research was in cancer genomics, and that's where I trained as an informatics scientist, genomics person, learned all about sequencing. I learned how to code over the course of grad school. I was really trained from the personalized medicine paradigm, and so I was really trained to think about how to study the cancer, which I applied to a number of cohorts, including several small phase two clinical samples that were collected from patients enrolled in them with head and neck cancer. But that was also my first exposure to immunotherapy. Bob Schreiber was actually on my committee, another friendly Pisces face. I started attending his lab meetings so that I could learn cancer immunology, so that I could at least try and understand a bit of what was happening in the trial I was studying. And it gave me a small dose of the field, but over the course of that time came all of the early approvals of the early checkpoint inhibitors. And so when I was considering my postdoctoral studies, that was something that I needed to understand better, but I could also bring my skill set to apply to larger phase two trials, which is what I'm currently doing in Tony's lab.
So diving into that, tell us a little bit more about the work you are doing in Tony's lab. What is the focus? And I think you've got some really unique approaches to dive in there. So it'd be wonderful to hear a little bit more about your current work.
So when I joined Tony's lab, it was really bringing a lot of that sequencing expertise and saying, what do we do with all of these biopsies that are collected from patients enrolled, particularly in SWOG clinical trials? Prior to my joining, Tony was the chair of the melanoma committee. And so he was heavily involved with the organization development of the larger phase two cooperative group studies that enroll patients across the country. And so with these three trials and working closely with several clinical PIs, all of the biopsies that were collected were sent to UCLA. And so it started out with, we have to sequence these biopsies because those are the types of really informative pieces that we can put together. But as we optimized the strategies from a translational standpoint, we realized that we could really leverage a lot of the cutting edge technologies, which has really expanded those projects to say, how much can we do with a biopsy? And so now we're doing, we're exploring a lot in the spatial profiling space with regards to the multiplex protein technologies, and lately even thinking about some of the spatial transcriptomics, taking those biopsies and adding a billion dimensions to say what's working for patients.
This is a big push, I think, not just in Pisces, of course, but really across the entire immunotherapy space, is getting a better understanding of the spatial relationship. Can you tell me a little bit more? What do you think that brings to the table And what kind of novel insights do you think we can expect to see in the next 5 years with the huge spatial push that people are doing now?
I think what's really interesting is to see the waves of technology and then informatics that we see, or informatics slash analysis. And my brain always goes back and I say, okay, I learned genomics and genomic analysis. And that's what, after they optimized the short read sequencing and we were able to parallelize a lot of that, and the cost was scalable. And then over the course of my graduate studies, I saw the development of it got really exciting to see single cell DNA sequencing, but there's a lot of challenges to that. But then the single cell RNA sequencing wave hit, and then it was like a lot of data, a lot of technology. And then it was like, okay, now we have to make sense of it. And so there was this huge wave of all of these single cell approaches. And then the caveat being single cell, we didn't have where they were. And so you've had this wave again of technology. And so I think we're transitioning from that phase of the heavy emphasis on technology. Maybe one's better than the other. A lot of them are giving us similar information, and we have to think about cost and resources to make that decision. And I think now we're again in this phase of understanding what we can do with it. And I think of it in three scales. One is like the highest level, zoomed out, pathologic. What does the biopsy look like? What is the whole sample? What is the landscape? And so that's like looking at the whole map. But then you can zoom in and start to say, okay, here's the tumor area, or here's the mic, or here's the vasculature. And so you can take that next zoom in and you see some people looking at the tumor edge. And so I think of that more at the community level. But then you can also really zoom in even further with the resolution. We're getting down to subcellular resolution to say where these proteins are and what interactions are driving these cellular dynamics. And so I know in the past, we always talked about biopsies and samples as a snapshot. But who's to say that we're not capturing dynamic activity? And so I think it's going to be really cool as the math gets better to better quantify and confidently state these things. And what's better about imaging is that we can go back and look at it, right? It's like we can save that picture. And so we can go back and say, do we believe it? So.
Do you think, I know that from the single cell data you can use, and I guess as we push forward into spatial transcriptomics, and then we improve our resolution, do you think there's a possibility where you'd be able to do not just biopsies, but to begin to think about doing in situ trajectory analysis, where you're looking not just at a cell, but saying, hey, as a cell enters the tumor microenvironment, because you've got the coordinates of that cell, we've got a certain pattern of RNA splicing that tells me these genes are turned on recently versus not. And then in cells that are outside the tumor microenvironment, maybe an approaching on the edge, can you begin to paint a picture, as you were saying, in time, how things change dynamically as cells enter and exit this environment, just computationally, moving away, using tools that were really developed for single cell RNA sequencing to try to get more data out of it? Do you think there's something there, or do you think maybe because of the, I don't know, the amount of information you can recover, is there something else that we can do that can get you that info?
So I don't think we're there yet, but I think about it, and the question I get anymore is, how is AI impacting your research? Which is a really important question. Secretly, AI has been part of the research since the beginning in some way, even at the most basic levels. I think the challenge that we face is too much information. From all of that, how do you hone in on the one piece of information, or the couple pieces of information, likely couple pieces of information? And how do you put those together to say, this is outcome, this is going to turn into outcome X, or this is what's happening, or this is some sort of classification there?
Right.
I think it really depends on what those features are. There's a lot that we can glean from just a couple markers in melanoma to say, this is a T cell, this is a melanoma cell. This is where those T cells are, and those are interacting or not. And depending, there's also added information. This patient was being treated with drug X at this time, and they did not respond. And so I think it's going to be a huge movement of too much information to figure out what those couple pieces of information are. And depending what those informations are and the resolution required, I think if we're trying to capture alternative splicing events in real time, it's going to be really hard to say that that's what's happening. But if that alternative splicing is resulting in a different protein and you have a specific antibody for that, I think logically, like I could see it happening. I can't say confidently that it will, but it has, I think that feature has to be confidently tied with outcome X. And then we can think about how to strategically find it actively in patients.
Yeah, you bring up a really good point that whenever you approach a complex problem like that, it helps to bring a question. What is it that you want to know? And not just try to paint a picture. So what do you think the key kind of questions that are arising now in terms of our key kind of areas in immune suppressive microenvironments, particularly in the tumor microenvironment? What are the key players that are coming out that are interesting to you personally? And the field is wide and broad and everybody's interested in different things. But for you, what do you think the is really most interesting in that environment? Cell types, metabolism, biology, suppressive factors. What do you think?
I have a couple of hot takes on this.
Right, let's do it. That's
great. Probably because I'm not classically trained as an immunologist and I don't have necessarily a favorite immune cell the way that some individuals do, which is fair. I respect it, but it's not my bag. So I think we're past hot and cold.
Yeah, sure.
I'm a great person in general, so I don't like the whole extremist. So I think we're past hot and cold, and now we're starting to have the right information to delineate the things that are the spectrum of things that are that range there. Because is it cold? Is your definition cold that there's no inflammation? Is your cold the fact that there's no CD8s? Is it just no T cells at all? And that's really interesting to consider as we think about some of the drugs that are used, because some of them modulate the microenvironment. I think ipilimumab is a great example of that. But one of the classic differentiating features of PD-1 inhibition working is whether those CD8s are there. And again, with this spatial technology, and I think Miriha Cohen's work is one of my favorite, as well as Karen Pilka, looking at those communities and those hubs and how those couple cells work together. I think I get a little lost by all of the myeloid populations, because what we see in real time in clinical biopsies is that's a spectrum, right? And these cells aren't always as differentiated as we think they are.
Not just looking at cells, but really communities of cells, right? So lymphoid aggregates and the composition of these aggregates. Because I think we're reductionists at heart, a lot of us, and that's a problem, because the system is an actual system, which is necessarily complex. And the biology of it is a communication between cells in time. And so when you're looking at this, are you starting to see in your own spatial work, are you starting to see different, even as it relates to the myeloid population, different interactions, different myeloid or different aggregates of lymphoid cells that then correlate with the core question you're asking, whether it's outcome or resistance?
Yeah, I think one of the coolest kind of analyses that we've done lately is rather than labeling like individual cells, labeling regions. And so there's a really talented individual that was/is training with Jim Heath as well, Daniel. He and I have been working on this problem together, where we started to think about the fact that you could call each of these individual blobs a tumor cell, right? But in reality, when a pathologist is looking at that image, they're saying, this is the tumor. They're not saying these are the cells. This is the tumor, because it is made up of tumor cells. And images are pixels. And so we assign those pixels to those individual cells. And so we say that this blobby thing is a cell. And so with imaging processing, this was a cool project that I worked with the Pisces informatics team. Rather than just saying these little blobby things are cells, we took all the blobs and we blobbed them together. Always love bubbles. And we call this now the tumor area. But that same kind of logic is applicable to things like necrosis. This area is necrotic, or fibrosis. This area is fibrotic, or this is a blood vessel. So I think we're getting at this cool level of getting into how to talk about things, not with respect to just the cellular interactions. And that's why I brought up those three levels of zooming in that we can say things with respect to the whole picture and put that in relation to each other. So we're constantly battling. I have a really great team of undergrads that I'm working with right now, and they're all working on different questions or different cohorts. And we all get really excited, and we're constantly like doing this zooming out, zooming in, and what is the effective way to describe the biology that's happening, quantify it.
That's great. I think that makes a lot of sense. From someone with a metabolomics background, that makes a huge amount of sense, because you really talk about regions of nutrient density. You don't really talk so much about cells. And these cells form proto-tissue that has nutrient shuttles and feed each other. And it's just how stuff works and its byproducts. And so I think that your approach there makes a huge amount of sense to kind of resign yourself to this immunology concept that cells are the agent, autonomous agents of change in an immune response, and that a cell can do something. It's no, cells don't do things on their own. It's a connection. And I think your work really highlights a lot of that. It's cool. So just getting onto the lab that you're in. So can you talk to me a little bit about the mentors you've had coming up in your career and where that's going? And I know you see the role of mentorship is too in where you've got today.
It took me a long time to fully appreciate what my teachers meant to me. And honestly, like as a kid, it was like I was a student and they were just part of your day to day. But thinking back, like they really did have a huge impact. I can go back to my fourth grade science teacher, and I claim that as like the origin story and why I wanted to get into science. Anyway, during my graduate training, I had an incredible mentor, Obi Griffith, and he has an identical twin brother. And I like to say I got two for the price of one, because both were so heavily involved with my training.
Great.
At the time, we were under the umbrella of Rick Wilson and Elaine Martis, who were co-directors of the Genome Institute. And Elaine was one of my rotation mentors, and I consider her a dear friend, colleague, mentor, advisor, guidance since then. And she is really... all of them have really supported me and helped me understand the steps to continue to pursue this trajectory. And then I got to my postdoc and I thought it couldn't get better. It was like when you think you have the best mentors in the world, how could it possibly get better? And then Tony Rebus is a force. And that renowned respect is seen from the clinical community, as well as the academic community, as well as the industry and other sides of it. It's amazing the impact that he's shared with so many people and across disciplines, because for him, it comes down to one thing, it's helping patients. So I could gush about that all day long. So for me, I look at it and my mentors have really made it so, not that science is easy, it's never been easy, but they've never made it harder than it had to be, which I think is a real testament to them, in addition to my thesis committee, my advisory committee, and my postdoc. And so that's something that I think what's amazing about the Bridge Fellowship is that transition that I get to experience going from a postdoc to establishing independence is I get the opportunity to do my best to emulate that for the students that I get to work with. And I hope that I fail to see that they could possibly see me in the same way, but I hope that they have such a positive experience in science and that I can support them in that as well. So
I'm sure they will. That was definitely an important point, because you're taking on undergraduates and other students in the lab, graduate students even. This is something I think just being the example that they look up to, I think is a really important part of it as well. It's not just words. So could you talk to, you mentioned the Bridge Fellowship. Could you talk a little bit about in your career as it begins to really move out toward more of an independent model, how does PICE play a role in that? How has it played a role in establishing you as an independent researcher?
I could talk about the role of PICE both as a collaboration as well as a direct fellow. It really started with that collaboration. And I think I was fortunate in the timing and types of projects that I was working on that I was introduced to Nikesh years ago, who was a leader in informatics at PICE. And so that led to a collaboration with starting with Danny Wells, but expanded to direct work because it was looking at it and saying, why can't we work together kind of thing? And that's led to standardized pipelines between our institution or within UCLA and PICE, standardized pipelines, new pipelines, new technologies, new types of analysis, just constantly pushing forward. The PICE community has been instrumental in all of that. So I can't, I can't imagine not being where I'm at without it, because it gave me so many other minds to bounce things off of from a data science perspective, and so many other people to learn from in parallel. And then when the Bridge Fellowship I'm at arguably, inarguably the most competitive time point of my career. I've heard a lot about the pay lines lately and thinking about federal funding and the rates of support for individuals at my position that are trying to transition to independence. I think the NCI K99 specifically is one of the most competitive mechanisms across all of the grants. I don't know the numbers exactly, but you put that into the context of an existential crisis of trying to make it in your career, it's pretty overwhelming. And so the Bridge Fellowship, and I think mine is in part supported by both PICE and the V Foundation, I think it's incredible to see this come together. And I think it's also emphasized in data informatics and saying we need to support these individuals. And part of that is the money to hit the ground running, to cover, to make you a competitive candidate in faculty interviews and to give you the appropriate amount of support to get those early experiments, get that early success in, because without that, whatever administration you enter into as a faculty member is going to be pretty challenging to say, no, you should hire me, keep me here, I'm worth it, I promise. And I can't emphasize what an honor it is to receive this funding, because it instills some level of confidence in me, but it also allows me to more confidently enter that arena and make it feel more possible rather than an impossible cause.
Yeah, that makes sense. It makes a huge amount of sense. And I think it's, for me personally, I got to say, I think it's the best program by far at PICE, no doubt about it, in terms of not just the individuals like yourself that can benefit from it, but it's really about building out kind of a next generation network that is both exposed to the kind of culture of the retreats and the different interactions and the collaborative projects, but really begins to see that as the norm, that people should collaborate and exchange data and share data and be completely open. Because I can tell you that if you ask Bob Shriver or you ask Tony, this is not the norm. Like it's quite an interesting and unique community. And I think to be mentored and to not just come up in it, but to begin to establish a next generation norm for this, it's exciting as a launchpad where this just doesn't even, with you and the other scholars and fellows that have come up in labs out of PICE, this is just going to change the way we do science. And so we're hugely excited by this initiative and what it does for the Institute and hopefully what it does for immunotherapy.
Me too.
So one area though, is you are pushing out into independence and you're thinking about the projects that you want to do in your lab as you begin to establish it. What are the areas that you're most excited about? And you have the exposure to the network. You've got a great line of sight across all of immunotherapy. What do you think is the things in not just your own work, but even across the board that you think are areas that are expanding that you're most excited about in cancer immunotherapy?
So I'll pick two major ones. The first one is honestly the Bridge Fellowship directly funded this project in terms of looking at the status of the HLA machinery on tumor cells and how that's modulated. I'm a little proud to say that my grant is more about proving a negative than it is proving a positive, because melanoma cells don't lose or have loss of heterozygosity in the HLA complex, gene complex. And I have a pretty big theory on why that doesn't happen, but obviously scientifically you can't necessarily prove that, but you can prove it by saying this is happening in other cancers. And I'm really excited to continue expanding upon how we can study these really hard regions of the genome from a genomics perspective, things like the HLA complex. I'm excited to expand that into the cure genes and think about, honestly, the HLA and NK cell dynamics, as well as the HLA T cell dynamics based upon, because those cures get thrown around by the T cells as well as some sort of regulations. And I think a lot of that ties back into, I think we need to do a better job of looking at the axis of immunogenicity of tumors with their oncogenicity. And so thinking about those classic drivers and putting it into the context of the molecular subtypes, there were a lot of great successes out of the TCGA project. We learned a lot, and we also learned what mistakes had been made. Now it's looked at, and there's a lot of elements of how those samples were collected that make it not the most appropriate comparator in a lot of the studies that we do. But looking back, it defined the genomic landscape of cancer, right? And so I think we need to start bringing these things back together, because sometimes tumor cells are going to grow too fast. It's a simple dynamics numbers game. But sometimes those genetic mechanisms are going to be in some way interplaying with immune evasion or modulating the tumor microenvironment. And so I think now that we're starting to get into an increased numbers, increased data perspective, I think we can start to clear some of that out. Because I think some of those selective pressures are responsible for the changes that we see in the antigen presentation machinery. Okay. The other one that I'm really excited about that I have absolutely no projects in, so I guess I'm giving away an idea, is the fact that the spatial technologies, seeing this subcellular resolution, I think I'm excited to really stress the fact, and for those who have worked with me, they know that I want to stress the fact that the spatial technologies are not single cell technologies. They're single cell resolution. When you do something like flow cytometry or single cell RNA-seq or single nuclei, in each of those bubbles, in each of those measurements, you are measuring one cell.
Exactly.
You're looking at a cell and butt it up against another cell, and the pixelation, you're actually getting that cell in the context of the things around it.
Sure.
But what that allows us to say is cell one is interacting with cell two, and the resolution of the technology also sees the gradation of that. And we know that certain proteins and intracellular dynamics are activated or associated with that interaction. So I'm really excited about the idea that as we continue, because we're not going to stop genetically engineering T cells, as we continue to genetically engineer T cells and make them see what we want them to see, or make them function in the way that we want to function, I think with the spatial, particularly the spatial transcriptomics, I think it'll be cool to say, how are we changing the biology of a T cell based upon, and how are those interactions fundamentally different? What are we missing that might be important from an endogenous perspective to really leverage the power of a T cell?
Oh, no, that's cool. It's because I think you can, in that same image, and it's already embedded in your statement, that you could see whether or not something's working or not. Okay, this is working and this isn't working. And it'd be really fun to do in that context is if actually you went ahead with something that Tony's talked about and others, which is you did combinatorial kind of library screen where you had multiple chimeric antigen receptors or multiple genetic modifications, and you just went in and said, okay, this 50% made it into the tumor. So that's cool. Now we've got these interaction interfaces, as you said, and that you've got positive ones and negative ones in terms of signaling. And what are the components on the immunological synapse on both sides that are assembling? That's cool. That's really, really nice. Do that. That's really cool. Yeah, that's a really good idea. I think it speaks to what your own work, where you're really leveraging that concept of not just cellularity, but regional biology. And I think it makes a huge difference. So you can redefine what cytokines do as well. You know what I mean?
It's thinking about the CAR trials or the TCR trials. And honestly, show me the ones that have failed. Get those clinical biopsies. And we have the ability to say that cell is the product that we put into that patient. And those biopsies tell us, are the T cells getting to the tumor? Doing bulk TCR sequencing is not fully saying that T cells getting into the tumor. It's telling me it's in that sample. And so you can say where it's getting stopped along the way, what's missing. And I think it really can fuel a lot of the combinatorial strategies that we might need to consider to boost them.
So I think you mentioned like TCGA and these kind of bigger initiatives, right? Like maybe a single atlas and protein atlas and all these kind of wonderful big things. We're well positioned to do big things at the Parker Institute. What do you think we should do? Like what are the big ideas that you could think of next that would really help your research, whether it's samples or match? Everyone would love some samples and match clinical data, but are there other big initiatives in terms of cell banking or combinatorial libraries that we should be doing that really make a big impact in the field? You think is missing? Maybe NCI is not doing it yet, that other philanthropic funds just haven't tried to tackle it yet, particularly for that would affect your research.
I think one of the greatest advantages of the PiSeq community is the brain trust that it basically is, right? And so what I don't think we have a good sense of is all of the data that's available. And so finding a way to centralize those resources and make them supportive, not just of the Pisces community, but of the world. And I think things like CCLE or TCGA, those were really good at providing the right models or appropriate settings to think about targeted therapies, but there's not necessarily a comparator with regards to the right resources for evaluating immunotherapies. So which models have been evaluated? What are the valid, like a centralized resource to say, these are the antigens of interest. This is its matching TCR to get that vector. And so thinking about all of the cell lines, but also the patient or like the TILs that were created from those samples as well, that reveals a whole new world in terms of humanized mouse models and a whole bunch of other things. So I think something I would like to continue seeing, and there's already elements of it, we completed it with the Melanoma IO project, Morrison, harmonizing all of the retrospective data that we could get our hands on to understand PD-1 inhibition, biomarkers associated with PD-1 inhibitors in melanoma, but expanding upon that and extending it to the models, because you also want to know, did that cell line come from a tumor that then responded to immunotherapy? So figuring out how to more comprehensively bridge the translation, not just from a clinical samples perspective, but also those models.
Yeah, that's a huge one. I think it's as you start to take that next step into therapeutic development, this is the big, you've just keyed in on probably the biggest gap is how do we even test this? Not just to take it, but at this point, I think a lot of the models that we have are not just built for really understanding. They're more just things you do to get regulatory buy-in. They really don't have a ton of predictive value, maybe relative predictive value in terms of the choices that you make, but it's not going to tell you whether it's working in the clinic. And I think we've, a lot of drug developers have given up on small animal models. You see it from recent FDA documents where they say you don't even need them. So I think if we have ones that are really predictive that describe that microenvironment well, I think it's not just a deeper understanding of what's going on there and test your hypothesis. It's great for therapeutic development. So it speaks directly. It's a great idea. I think it's something that we should double down on. There's another area there is organoids too. So iPSC derived organoid cultures. And this is something I think that a lot of your colleagues in the network are really fascinated by the potential of, or maybe they're just sitting back and waiting for somebody else to do it. But it's an area that as we get to parallelize a lot of our technology development, we need ways to do this in a more high throughput manner. Humanized mice are great, but they're tough to get right. And there's very few labs in the world that can give you a really complex one. So we're excited to look at that work as well, try to get great killing assays and move that forward.
Yeah, I think this needs to start being emphasized prospectively, because retrospectively, you can't always get that information back from the patient. And sometimes the sample that it came from, that lesion wasn't documented, or you don't know exactly where it came from to say, was it the responding one, the non-responding one? And so I think a huge emphasis could be placed on the clinical annotation of these samples moving forward to say, this is the time point for which this was collected. So this is what you need to know in order to understand that model.
You speak of models, and I didn't ask you about AI, you brought it up, but how do you see that though? Like, I mean, it's something how do you see that applying to the more complex models that you're building? I know that there are groups that are just completely open to creating models to try to predict outcome for checkpoint inhibition, and this is out there. But how do you see it apply to your work and actually even some of the things we talked about, model systems?
So I'm not a big fan of the black box. I want to know what's in the black box and what's making it run. So when it comes to machine learning, I'm not the biggest fan of things using deep learning and things that I can't dig into to figure out what's responsible for why the outcome is working. So I'm more of a how person. I always tell Tony, he's good at the what and I'm good at the how. And so we talk about what needs to be done and why, and then I have to like figure out how to do it, which is really fun. So I think machine learning can fill in that gap and make that math a lot easier.
Yeah, I think I think a lot of people see it that way, particularly in coding and creating. It just accelerates steps.
Right. And yeah, I have so many analogies. Why walk to work when you can drive or bike? There are benefits to learning and understanding. And then there's also you have to get where you need to go. So I think there's this huge dystopic scenario where robots take over the world. But what I think is that these models can perform the really hard math for us to say which features are most important. And I think the biggest takeaway, at least in what I'm doing, is that I think what that allows us to do is take this really hard stuff, this really complicated stuff, and simplify it down to take things back to patients. When you think about the clinical setting, they don't want to look at 1,000 things at a time. They don't want to think about the fact that there's 1,000 features that you put together. They want that test to run and they want the outcome and they want it to work.
Yeah.
So if we can narrow down on the handful of things that will most confidently give us a positive outcome for the patient, those are the things that we can take back to the clinical setting and work with the clinicians and the people interfacing with the patients, I'm not one of them, and say, here's how we can strategically treat these patients with things that are going to work. And so I think that's my favorite part of the AI revolution, re-revolution. There's consistently an AI revolution. I think that is one of the biggest takeaways, is thinking about how this will simplify things, and it will also accelerate the translation back to patients.
Yeah, absolutely. It's huge, this concept of AI-driven treatment regimes and best outcomes, and given the data that you're developing in the translational suite to guide that. So we're hugely excited about it too. And Katie, if there's anything else that you want to add or anything like that to this, I just want to really thank you so much for your time. I think it's been really fun talking to you about it, and looking forward to all the great work that you're doing too in the lab.
Thanks again for having me. It's really cool to get to talk about these various thoughts, hot takes. And I hope there's certain things I'm wrong about in 5 years, right? It'd be completely different.
I think that the approach that you're taking is refreshing. So you get one of the worst things is you can get locked, particularly if in a network like this, is you can get locked into ways of thinking. When you're hanging out with people and you're hearing really smart people talk about CD4s are really important, it's okay. I'm sure they are really important. But let's really talk about, let's rethink what you mean by a cell. That's a more fundamental question. And it's something that your research is bringing to the forefront. And it's one that we're real excited to see as well, for sure.
I appreciate it.
Thanks for listening to From Bench to Fireside. And special thanks to this season's PiSE Network contributors from Dana-Farber, UCSF, Stanford Medicine, Mount Sinai, UCLA, Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, and Weill Cornell Medicine. To donate to support PiSE's mission, please visit parkerici.org/donate. You can find From Bench to Fireside on Spotify. To be notified of new episodes, like or subscribe to our channel. For the latest at the Parker Institute for Cancer Immunotherapy, follow us on X and LinkedIn at ParkerICI, or visit www.parkerici.org to learn how we aim to accelerate the development of breakthrough immune therapies to turn all cancers into curable diseases. From Bench to Fireside is produced by the Parker Institute for Cancer Immunotherapy. All content and opinions expressed in this podcast belong solely to the Parker Institute. From Bench to Fireside is a trademark of the Parker Institute for Cancer Immunotherapy. We'll see you next time as Parker Network experts in immunotherapy take you from behind the lab bench to the frontiers of cancer research.